America Looks Abroad, presented at this hour on Sunday afternoon by the officers and staff members of the Foreign Policy Association. This nonpartisan organization, which is open to all who are interested, offers accurate information on current world events. One outstanding aspect in the international scene, which we have not as yet treated in detail, is the position of the British Empire. Mr. James Frederick Green, the member of the research staff who follows British affairs, we'll discuss this today. Mr. Green.
Good afternoon. During the past week, Great Britain has been in the headlines even more than usual. German planes have launched new attacks against British shipping in the North Sea and have made reconnaissance flights along the English coast. For the first time in this war, a mine is reported to have sunk a ship in the Irish Sea. This is very important from the British point of view, because it means that their communications westward to Ireland and across the Atlantic are menaced by one weapon which they have not yet successfully controlled. Meanwhile, the British government has begun to ration food, and Prime Minister Chamberlain on Monday warned the British public that they would face grim sacrifices and a lower standard of living for the duration of the war. The first political crisis in Great Britain since the outbreak of war arose last week over the resignation of Leslie Horbelisha as Minister of War. We have no official explanations about his resignation, though presumably some will be forthcoming in Parliament on next Tuesday. So far, we have only the many different and often contradictory explanations offered by British newspapers. We know, for example, that Mr. Horbelisha enacted a number of far-reaching reforms throughout the British Army after he became War Minister in 1937. He reorganized the High Command and attempted to broaden the base of recruitment for officers in order to democratize an officer corps which traditionally had been restricted to the aristocracy and upper middle class. Perhaps these and other reforms, pushed very rapidly, aroused hostility in some military quarters. But these reforms were probably less important in the Horbelisha affair than certain basic questions of strategy. The War Minister frequently consulted Captain Liddell Hart, England's most famous military historian and critic. Liddell Hart has constantly urged that Great Britain should maintain a small mobile army for purely defense tactics on the Western Front and use its naval and air power, as well as expeditionary forces on other fronts, for offensive purposes. Now, this proposal, however sound in theory, raises many practical problems for responsible officers in the field. They very likely oppose any plan for diversion of their forces at this time, either to the Baltic or the Balkans. And finally, personal considerations certainly played their part in the cabinet shakeup. Mr. Horbelisha is known as a very dynamic, aggressive individual who often rides roughshod over other cabinet ministers and often forgets that teamwork is vital in any government, especially in wartime. There are reports that Mr. Chamberlain is considering a unification of all three defense departments under one minister, perhaps Winston Churchill, another very high-spirited gentleman. In that case, Mr. Horbelisha's resignation was possibly only a matter of time. But there is another important aspect to this episode. Many of Mr. Chamberlain's critics are more perturbed about certain other cabinet changes than they are over Mr. Horbelisha's resignation. To replace Mr. Horbelisha at the War Office, Mr. Chamberlain selected the Honorable Oliver Stanley, who is the son and heir of Lord Derby, one of Britain's largest landholders and wealthiest peers. Mr. Stanley had not shown any great distinction at the Board of Trade or in other offices. Back in 1934, he was actually supplanted at the Ministry of Transport by Mr. Horbelisha. And then to replace Oliver Stanley at the Board of Trade, Mr. Chamberlain went outside of Parliament entirely and selected Sir Andrew Ray Duncan, a representative of big business. Mr. Chamberlain also chose a new Minister of Information, Sir John Reith, who is well known for his administrative ability, but happens to be equally well known for his dislike of publicity and lack of contact with the general public. A number of British newspapers and magazines are expressing alarm over Mr. Chamberlain's appointments of wartime controllers, over shipping, food, raw materials, and other portions of the national economy. They point out that the Prime Minister is placing different sections of British industry and agriculture under their own representatives rather than under civil servants who can speak for the public. It happens to be a tradition of British government that great departments and offices, even in wartime, should be under politicians with a broad knowledge of public needs, and that experts and special representatives should be subordinate to the politicians. It is this tendency to place the control of Great Britain's economic mobilization into the hands of men with vested interests, which is arousing criticism. Some of these events have not enhanced the prestige of the Chamberlain cabinet in other countries. Mr. Chamberlain's government has been dominated by a rather small group of elder statesmen, the Prime Minister himself, Sir John Simon and Sir Samuel Hoare, and more recently, Lord Halifax and Winston Churchill. Very few members of this government have aroused great enthusiasm in Britain, even though the government still has public confidence, and certainly very little enthusiasm in the dominions or neutral countries. At least two exceptions do stand out, however. The Foreign Secretary, Lord Halifax, and the British Ambassador at Washington, Lord Lothian, have both succeeded in presenting the British cause very effectively. Lord Lothian gave an especially forceful and persuasive address before the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations about 10 days ago. He declared that the ultimate issue between Germany and Britain is one of sea power, and that at the end of this war, sea power must be placed under the joint control of the democracies. Well, there's a catch to this, of course, for sea power under the joint control of the democracies means sea power under the joint control of the British Commonwealth and the United States. This would mean that we in America would virtually guarantee the present British Empire and would assume unprecedented responsibility in world affairs. Both Lord Lothian and Mr. Chamberlain have emphasized Britain's determination to promote some federation of Europe. Mr. Chamberlain declared that the present close cooperation between Britain and France might well serve as the basis for some future European or even world union. When Lord Lothian said that the real issue in this war is one of sea power, he hit the nail on the head. It is becoming more and more clear that the immediate aim of Germany is to destroy British naval power and to overthrow Britain's financial and political power throughout the world. The British, of course, realize this quite clearly and are equally determined to preserve both their empire and their navy. They are naturally perturbed only over any close collaboration between Germany and the Soviet Union because they fear that Stalin agrees with Hitler in dislike of British power. Thus far, thanks to the Nazi-Soviet non-aggression pact of last August, the British have not been faced with the active hostility of either Italy or Japan, who likewise have ambitions against the British Empire. We in the United States have tended, I think, to overlook the assistance which Great Britain is receiving from various parts of its vast empire. The great self-governing dominions have of their own free will declared war on Germany and have mobilized their resources in defense of the Commonwealth. The Dominion of Canada, for example, has already sent one division for training in the British Isles, even though it has decided not to enforce conscription. The French-Canadian province of Quebec, which strongly opposed conscription in the World War, has made it clear that it will participate in this conflict, but only on a voluntary basis. The British expect to buy in Canada not only wheat and wool, nickel, gold, copper, and other minerals, but manufactures of many kinds. Canada is now one of the world's most important industrial nations and is to become the arsenal of the empire. The Canadian War Supply Board, which is purchasing for the Canadian as well as the British and French governments, has spent an average of $54 million a week. Out on the western plains of Canada, many new airfields and air schools are being constructed, and there, young men from all over the empire will be trained for air fighting on the western front. This scheme, which is to run for over 3 years, will cost at least $600 million, divided between the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. Australia and New Zealand, too, are playing their part in a war which is far from their own shores. These two dominions in the South Pacific realize that their territory and their political independence are safe only so long as the British Navy exists, or in event of a British defeat, only if the United States should intervene to redress the balance of power in the Far East. Their only potential enemy is Japan, not Germany. But they know full well the consequences of a German victory in Europe. The British government has already agreed to purchase from Australia all its exportable surpluses of wool, wheat, sugar, canned and dried fruits, and meats. It has likewise agreed to take all of New Zealand's surplus wool and dairy products. Then there is the Union of South Africa, which declared war on Germany only after Prime Minister Herzog resigned and General Smuts took over the government. South Africa will probably not send an expeditionary force, at least at present, but it will patrol and defend its own coasts. South Africa has been alarmed in recent years by the spread of Nazi activities within its own borders and by Germany's demand for restoration of colonies lost in the World War, one of which South Africa holds as a mandate. Both the wool and the gold of South Africa will prove of great value to Great Britain in this war. Only one section of the British Commonwealth has remained neutral, Erin or Ireland, which under its constitution is a sovereign and independent state. But Ireland may give Britain trouble, as it did in the last war, by widespread outbreaks of violence. The Irish government under Premier de Valera is now attempting to put down the Irish Republican Army, which demands immediate union of Erin and the six counties of Northern Ireland, which are still a part of the United Kingdom. Premier de Valera insists that this question of partition must be settled eventually, but only by peaceful means. All other outstanding issues between Great Britain and Ireland were settled by a treaty signed in 1938. Now, we should not forget that the British Empire stands or falls in this war not merely by effective use of its vast material resources, but by effective use of its great political skill, which traditionally has proved almost invulnerable. The British can gain great support, both in their empire and in neutral countries, if they can convince people that a British victory will contribute more than a German victory to a just peace. The British will be faced, of course, by a difficult political problem within their empire, the demand of India for self-government. The Congress Party in India demands that a constitutional assembly be convened immediately to decide the whole issue of India's government and relation to the empire. The British government, on the other hand, declines to discuss such complex issues until the war is ended, and argues that India, because of its class and religious divisions, is still not ready for complete self-government. The British government moved, perhaps too hastily, in declaring India a belligerent and in closing the door to any immediate constitutional changes. But it should not prove impossible to arrange some compromise solution which would give India dominion status and postpone any practical changes until the end of the war. It's of course too early to predict the outcome of this war or its ultimate effect upon the British Empire. The World War accelerated the trend toward nationalism and economic self-sufficiency within each dominion. Perhaps this conflict will reunite the dominions, both politically and economically. If so, the British Commonwealth might serve as one nucleus for some larger international organization. But it's also possible that economic nationalism might reappear in the different dominions, especially if they suffer another post-war depression. Whatever the outcome of this war, Great Britain will have to restore the freedom of investment and trade upon which its empire was built and maintained. All of these political and economic problems, however, await a military decision in Europe, which may be forthcoming this year.
You have been listening to Mr. James Frederick Green, Research Associate of the Foreign Policy Association, speaking in the series America Looks Abroad. In the world of today, foreign affairs are your affairs, and if you are interested in knowing the facts behind the headlines, send for a free copy of the weekly bulletin written by the people you hear on this program and carrying an article by Mr. Green. Address your letter or postcard to the Foreign Policy Association, 8 West 40th Street, New York. This is the National Broadcasting Company.